Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. This podcast is made possible by you, or at least it could be. It could be made possible by you. Giving Tuesday is December 3rd. We're doing a thing where we are trying to raise $100,000 on Giving Tuesday. I know it sounds like a lot. Let me go over, Eric, how this last year has been. Guys, the podcast network now averages over 175,000 monthly downloads, 175,000 every month. We have an online academy, free online academy, where you can take classes taught by professors and Eric and I, which is different, but for the most part, professors. But that academy has over 20,000 students enrolled. 20,000, and it's all free. I mean, we have articles every day. Our blog readership is over 40,000 unique people every month. We have the city events that we do, which costs they don't cost anything. You just show up and get to go to these things. All of this stuff is made possible because people contribute. People hold the rope, man. People get on board. And so, if the podcast has been helpful to you, but not just the podcast, this isn't just about supporting this podcast. It's about supporting all of those other things that do cost money and resources to produce, because we try to produce content that's not only good theologically, but that's quality. We don't want you to have to watch videos that are difficult to look at, or listen to podcasts that you can't hear what's going on, or put on events that aren't any fun to go to. So all of this stuff that we do in an effort to give people grace, give people Christ, give people comfort, all of that you can be a part of supporting. We're trying to raise some money on Giving Tuesday. Giving Tuesday is a day, it's December 3rd, where people give to nonprofits. And if you would like to join us, if you're someone who gives and you want to make an additional one-time gift that you can afford, that would be wonderful. If you've never given before, this is a great time to jump on and do it. I'll put a link in the description to the Giving Tuesday campaign, but you can also just go to 1517.org/GivingTuesday and you can, join the effort, man. Join the team and we can get more stuff done, even more stuff done in 2021.
That sounds good, Dan. We do have a lot of stuff coming up in 2021 too. I mean, I think about the trips to Germany and Sweden, where we get to preach the gospel to our brothers and sisters around the world there. And of course, the Here We Still Stand conference coming up again in 2021, which I know we're quickly selling tickets pretty fast this year, right?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, we're just rolling, man. God has been good to us.
Yeah, and by selling tickets, don't be deceived. We lose money on every ticket sold. If you've been to a Here We Still Stand, you know that cost of that ticket does not come anywhere close to covering what it costs to have an attendee there. We don't make any money on any of these things. And so, I mean, this is literally just the only reason we charge anything for the tickets to Here We Still Stand is to try to recoup a little bit, just a fraction of what it costs us to do it. So if you want to join up, now's the time, 1517.org/GivingTuesday, and that we would love to have your support. All right. We are in Luke chapter 6.
Indeed, we are. We pick it up at verse 1 of chapter 6 in Luke. On a Sabbath, while he was going through the grain fields, he, of course, here is Jesus, his disciples plucked and ate some heads of grain, rubbing them in their hands.
Delicious.
But some of their Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" Now, let me just stop there, because it's important to note that only some of the Pharisees said this. And I think the reason why that's pointed out is because actually what they're doing by rubbing these heads of grain in their hands is not technically unlawful according to what the scriptures actually teach. What was unlawful was to use a sickle or some sort of tool on the Sabbath. But by that time in the history of Judaism, and especially amongst the Pharisees, even rubbing the heads of grain with your hands was seen by some as unlawful. So they had added to the law beyond what the law had said.
Well, so they think it's two things. One, plucking a head of grain and rubbing it together is work. Now, this is not very hard work. But they would say, like, well, that's doing something.
Yes.
And what we're supposed to do is nothing.
And that's right.
That looks like something. And then the other thing that they could say it's preparing a meal.
That's right. Yeah. This is them being as ticky-tack as possible. But again, it's not because it's actually written in the law. It's their own way of applying the law in a more stringent way.
Yeah. And so
their accusation is hollow even from the beginning here.
Yeah. It's trying to take the letter of the law and just obliterate the spirit of the law.
Yeah. Which the Pharisees are, you know, good at doing, and the scribes are good at doing all throughout Jesus's ministry. And so what does Jesus do in his sort of, you know, typical way? He's able to bring up an example that's going to trap them. And it says, and Jesus answered them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priests to eat, and also gave it to those with him. And he said to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, this is a story that he references from 1 Samuel chapter 21, where he talks about David going in and eating the bread of the presence in the midst of a very difficult time with a very difficult campaign with some of the men that he was leading. And this was something indeed that wasn't lawful for him to do. And yet he does it, and no condemnation is given. So what's Jesus's great point here?
Well, I've heard some people try to explain how this wasn't actually unlawful this wasn't like a breaking of any sort of rule. This is entirely false. It absolutely was. David is not allowed to do this.
Yep.
And what he does, though, in that moment is that he's got these men whom he's in charge of. They are out on this campaign. They're hungry. And at that moment, David does the opposite of what the Pharisees do and goes with the spirit of the law over the letter of the law. So
yeah,
in David's
right.
mind, like taking care of those whom are in his charge is more in heart with the totality of the spirit of the law than obeying this one letter of the law. I mean, I guess one way to look at it would be that the greater sin would be to let his men go hungry.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the reason it's interesting that Jesus doesn't bring up how they're actually wrong about their application of the law here, but instead just brings up a situation where David, who would, you know, was obviously allowed to do this because he was king of Israel at the time, he's not condemned and he's allowed to do this. And I think the point is Jesus is saying, if David was allowed to do this and I am the Son of Man, because that's who he ends with, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath, then I have all the more authority to do what I'm doing right now. So leave me alone. I mean, it is interesting that this is a very explicit declaration of who he is. I mean, he actually says the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.
Well, what happens all the time with Jesus is that they try to trap him with the law. And when you take something like the Sabbath, Jesus is saying, like, look, I'm Lord of the Sabbath. In other words, the Sabbath is not over me.
Mm-hmm.
So the Sabbath is given so that man, in the course of a fallen world, has a day of rest. Jesus is obviously our ultimate rest, but mm-hmm. even still, Jesus is there are those even in modern times that will do this too. They will talk about the law in such a way as if it is over God, as if like the only thing that God is subservient to is the law, right? Mm-hmm. And so Jesus comes in here and they like start talking a mess about Sabbath rules. Well, the Sabbath is not God over Jesus. He's the one that gave man the Sabbath so they have a day of rest. But he's like, look, the law is not the one thing that is more powerful or more holy or higher than me.
Yeah, Jesus, when he says he's the Lord of the Sabbath, this was obviously very controversial amongst them. And not just because he's clearly claiming to be a messianic figure, but also because this was just contrary to the way they thought about everything. The law was, in some sense, God. The
right.
law had become God to them.
Yeah.
And Jesus has to restructure their whole way of thinking.
This
there.
Exists today. This totally exists today, that where the law becomes God.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not a word that came from God because of sin, to expose sin, which Paul explicitly says the reason the law was given was to show that you're a sinner, to increase the trespass, as he says, which means to magnify, to amplify, to put a microphone in front of the trespass. No, it is God at this point. And when Jesus says that he's Lord of the Sabbath, this is not the same thing as saying, I am the fulfillment of the Sabbath, which is certainly true.
Yeah.
That Jesus is our Sabbath rest. This is also stated in Hebrews, that Jesus is our Sabbath rest. What he's saying here is that he is over it, that he is higher, he is above it, that he is master of it, that he is not the servant of the Sabbath.
And that theme really continues as we move on in the next passage in verse 6. It reads, on another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might find a reason to accuse him.
This is just horrible.
That picture. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't this just the picture of the way the legalist works? I mean, whether back then or modern day, legalist is just always looking for someone to screw up, for just a way to accuse him.
Oh, dude, what do you think about this? The guy got a withered hand. This guy is suffering, and they're looking at Jesus, and they're not like, I wonder if he's going to heal him. That would be wonderful.
Oh, it would be so glorious.
They're like, I wonder if he's going to heal him. Man, I hope he does. Then we can accuse him of breaking the law. Like, you want to talk about, like, not understanding the law.
Yeah, this is clearly legalism at its height right here.
Yeah, because at this point, for them, the law is literally just do's and don'ts.
Yeah.
There is no spirit of the law. There is no heart of the law. There is none of this. It is just do's and don'ts. It's you shall and you shall not. That's it.
Well, and this is what, I mean, Paul, if you wanted a more detailed discussion about the difference between the spirit and the letter, go look at what Paul has to say in his letters to the Corinthians, and you'll see him make these distinctions, which are very important, because if you don't make these distinctions, you can easily fall into this, because let's just be honest, Dan, it's more comfortable to live a life of just do's and don'ts. It's more comfortable to live a life where there's not gray. And when you enter into the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter of the law, well, then you might get a little gray like these kinds of situations here.
Right.
Where you're like, well, should I rub that head of grain or not? I don't know. You know, well, what does it technically say? Well, that you're not addressing what the reasons were for the law in the first place.
This is why when Jesus is asked about the law all the time, he's like, love God and love neighbor. And people are really uncomfortable with this because they're like, you got a list? And like, yeah, you have the Ten Commandments, but that's not what Jesus brings up. He's like, love God and love neighbor. And like, they're like, ah, it's not detailed enough. I need some boxes to check. I need some do's and don'ts. And he's like, love God and love neighbor. And what he's doing when he does that is he is, and of course this is out of Deuteronomy, but what he is saying is that the law boiled down is this. I mean, he says this is the sum of the law, that if you want to know what the heart of the law, the spirit of the law is, it is love God and neighbor. This list of things, all these details, are just to show you all the ways that you haven't.
Yeah, and there's myriad ways that they haven't, of course. But they've ignored that, and they've tried to lessen what the law actually says in order to make it feel like they've fulfilled it, which is what every legalist has to do. Every legalist, every single time, has to lessen the force of the law to make it seem doable in their own strength.
Yeah,
that's just the reality.
It's the weird antinomian move in reality when you take all the bite out of the law and you instead make it a list of things to do and a list of things not to do, and then you see if you can check those boxes, and you had that way have disregarded the law, which says love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself.
Anything less than that is not fulfilling the law.
Correct.
Let's just be very clear about that. Anything less than that. So if anybody wants to talk about fulfilling the law, you know, whether you be a Christian or not, that's what it means to fulfill the law. And if you haven't done that, then you still are in need of grace.
Yes.
There's no other way around it.
And this is why it's evident in the life of Jesus that he does fulfill the law, because he does love God perfectly. He only does what the Father tells him, right? This sort of thing. And he does love his neighbor as himself. I mean, you see it throughout his earthly ministry, him just loving people all over the place, having compassion on people, but then ultimately loving people more than himself by going and dying for all of them.
That's right, yeah. And so it says, verse 8, but he knew their thoughts, and he said to the man with the withered hand, come and stand here. And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to them, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or destroy it? And after looking around at them all, he said to him, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored. Now, let me just stop there before we hear what their reaction is. Because Jesus is clearly like, there's this sense in which he's a little bit, he's putting on a show, calls this guy up to the front, you know, in front of everybody. He's like, let me ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it? And no one says anything. It's quiet. And so he looks around at them all first. Luke notes that for us and then says, stretch out your hand. And heals him.
Yeah, what he does by asking this question that no one responds to is he's not only going to ask him a question that they won't answer, but then he's going to do the thing, and they're not going to be able to say anything about that either, because anything that they would say after that would be perceived as an answer to this question that nobody wants to answer.
Yeah. And so what does the legalist do in a situation like this? Well, this is their response. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus.
I don't think this
so
was
here
like...
you have a glorious healing of somebody and their response is fury.
Yeah, I don't think when they were discussing what they might do to him, I don't think they were talking about like throw a party, you know, invite him over to start, you know, to lead a Bible study in the synagogue. I don't think this is the kind of stuff that they're talking about. Like maybe we'll buy him a new, you know, new cloak. This guy's really helping people out. This is not the kind of stuff they were thinking about doing to him.
No, this is clearly undermining the system that they had built. And the system that they had built, as we've talked about many times, was ticky-tack law, ticky-tack legalism. This was why they existed. I mean, they needed to have these things in place. And Jesus is going around blowing this stuff up, and it's driving them absolutely crazy. I mean, no one in their right mind, unless they've been poisoned by legalism, would see anything but great news in this healing. No one. Everyone would go, this is amazing. He just healed a man who knows for how long he's suffered with this disease. And yet these guys are so blinded by their need to keep whatever perceived rules they think they have in place that they can't see the glory in this. They can't see the good news.
Yeah, it's interesting that what Jesus does here is that, so the Sabbath is a day given for you to sort of be restored or be rejuvenated, right? It's a day of rest. And what Jesus does here is directly in line with that. Like, what does he do? He restores this man on the day of rest. He makes this man whole on the day of rest. And nothing could be more in line with the Sabbath.
There's also an implication here by his question that because he does have the ability to heal this man, that if he didn't heal this man, it would almost be like he was committing a sin of omission.
Yeah, this is the for those of you who know what to do but don't do it, this is sin.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, for Jesus not to heal this man, it would be like doing harm to this man, or it would be like destroying this man because he can fix it. And so the application to these Pharisees would be, if you can help somebody on the Sabbath, even if it means you're going to have to get up and do something that you wouldn't normally do on the Sabbath, then you do it because that's the point of the Sabbath. The right. point of the Sabbath was for restoration and for life-giving to people.
Right.
And so now we move on, verse 12. In these days, he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles, Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew, his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. So not much to say there as far as I think you, for probably most of our listeners, you know who the apostles are, and there's not much that Luke leaves out. He even notes here early on, almost to prepare the reader as if they're going through it, like, oh yeah, and one of them is going to be a betrayer of Jesus, Judas Iscariot.
Yeah, the one thing unique about this is that it lets you know that Jesus had quite a large group of people following him around. And he, at some point, you know, in his ministry, then pulls out 12 to commission them to be apostles. And so I think a lot of times we think that Jesus is just roaming around with 12 guys and that's it. And there are times where it's probably just Jesus and the 12, but through the majority of his ministry, we see just all kinds of people following him.
Yeah. Yeah. The 12 are specially designated for specific jobs and for specific callings, but he has many other followers that are with him, as we'll see in the next passage. One thing I do want to note about the differences in the apostles is you do have people from very different backgrounds with very different lives coming together underneath the head of Jesus as their leader. Think about the contrast between, say, Matthew, a tax collector who had been recently called by Jesus to follow him, and Simon, who was called the Zealot. The Zealot was, you know, as pro-nationalistic Israel as you got, part of groups usually that were, you know, not opposed to assassinating Roman leaders and things like that. You know, contrast that with Matthew, who was a Roman collaborator as a tax collector.
Yeah,
and yet Jesus is able to bring them all together.
Yeah, a Zealot is what Barabbas was.
Yeah.
They're insurrectionist.
Yeah. So Jesus is able from the very beginning here, if there's one thing that you can kind of pull out of this, is Jesus has a pretty diverse group of people from the beginning as his leaders, people that normally wouldn't get along well together, normally wouldn't work together on much of anything, but that's what Jesus does. And he still does that today. I've shared this story many times before in, you know, my pulpit ministry and things, but I remember some years ago walking around Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica with a few friends of mine, and we were all, they were two fairly new Christians and then me, and we were out just walking around, didn't really have much to do. They were dressed so, so differently than me. They were into such different things than me. We didn't have really all that much in common, if truth be told, except that we were Christians. And we're walking by this guy who was speaking on one of these platforms there. He was actually doing some street preaching in Santa Monica. And some of his helpers were handing out tracts. And one of them handed a tract to me and my two friends and then looked at us and just seeing how different we were said, wait, wait, wait. You guys must be Christians. There's no way you guys would be hanging out together unless you were Christians, right? So he was able to pick up on the fact that we were Christians just from how different we looked and yet how we were hanging out. And I think about this passage when I think about stuff like that, that God is able to bring together people from every sort of background, all tribes, nations, tongues, and peoples, as the book of Revelation will say so often, to be all part of his one body.
Yeah.
And so verse 17, we pick up, and he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out from him and healed them all. So here's that example of these great crowds that are following Jesus. Yes, he has the 12 apostles that are with him to do ministry alongside of him and to be sent out on mission. But everywhere he goes, he has gigantic crowds, and it says of his disciples and a great crowd of people following him around.
Yeah, and Tyre and Sidon are interesting places in the biblical narrative as well. They come up a lot.
Not very Jewish places.
No, they're not. They're Gentile places.
Yeah, so he's got people from not just Jewish lands coming to him, but he's got people from outside coming to him too, hoping to get healed and hoping to hear something from his lip.
There's some historical figures from Sidon, Queen Jezebel. So that's not a great one.
No.
But then also Zarephath, the widow that Elijah took care of, that's also Sidon. And so Sidon is in the Old Testament a lot. And then there are mention of people coming from Tyre and Sidon when the Messiah comes. And so this is not an accident that Luke brings this up.
No, it really is a precursor meant to show that Jesus is the Messiah for more than just Israel, for more than just the Jewish people. And he puts in these hints throughout his narrative, but of course, it gets more full as the narrative goes on. And so we head into the very beginning of the Beatitudes. We will not be able to finish all of that today. Now, one thing you'll notice about the Beatitudes in Luke, as opposed to the Beatitudes in Matthew, is that there is some difference in wording. And there may be reasons for that, but let's listen to it and let's see what he has to say. It says, and he lifted up his eyes on his disciples and said, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you and revile you and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for so their fathers did to the prophets. Now, the primary difference here, Dan, when you look at Matthew's account of the Beatitudes, Matthew, and maybe they're actually different times in which Jesus gives these Beatitudes, could be completely likely that Jesus just speaks these sayings twice. But in Matthew's account, he says, blessed are you who are poor in spirit. In Matthew's account, he says, blessed are you who hunger and thirst for righteousness, that aren't merely hungry. And so there are some differences there. I do think Luke is probably getting to the same meaning as what Matthew says.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not unlikely that Jesus said the same sorts of things multiple times. Any preacher knows that this is something that happens, mm-hmm. you know, and so and he sort of has not a lot of messages to say. I mean, he's sort of mm-hmm. there to do some pretty narrow things. Yeah, I think this could just be different. And you don't know the context in which he's talking about. He is, in both of the instances in Matthew and Luke, he is talking to his disciples.
Yeah.
Like, so this is expressly talking to his disciples. Now, the question is this his disciples in the broad sense, or is this the apostles? But we just saw the distinction made, and we're not mm-hmm. really told here.
Yeah, I think that, but overall, the point is the same as it would be in Matthew's, which is all of these things depict somebody who is dependent, who does not have enough in their own strength to be able to provide for themselves, who are hungry now, who weep now. These are people that know that they need a savior. These are people that know they can't cut it in their own strength. And I think that that's ultimately what Jesus's point is here when he talks about them being blessed.
Well, you got to know that either whether he's talking to the apostles or just like, you know, disciples broadly, these are supposed to be words of comfort. So if he's not talking spiritually, like the poor in spirit and the hunger and thirsting for righteousness, which is what's happening in Matthew, maybe what if he is just speaking, you know, horizontally, physically?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's talking mm-hmm. about people who are following him, who believe in him. And he's saying, hey, if you're poor, be glad. Yours is the kingdom of heaven. Now, he doesn't say, because you're poor, yours is the kingdom of heaven. He's mm-hmm. saying, you may be poor, but be glad. Yours is the kingdom of God. In other words, like, this is temporary, and you mm-hmm. believe in me, and you will inherit the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. If you are hungry, even if it's literal hunger, if you like, don't have enough food, be glad. Like, the day is coming when you will be satisfied. Mm-hmm. And if you are weeping, which of course life is, life contains a lot of suffering, you believe in me, be glad, like the day is coming that you will laugh. And when people hate you and exclude you and revile you and spurn you and on account of me, take heart. The day is coming where you will rejoice. Your reward lies in heaven. And so yeah. there's nothing in this that you could take and say, whichever way you take it, whether you take it spiritually or just practically, there's nothing in this that you could say, well, the kingdom of God belongs only to poor people and hungry people and weeping people. This is not not say this. He says,
no,
though these things are true, because you believe in me, like there is something better coming for you.
Yeah, this is just meant to be a great word of encouragement to those who have experienced life's hardships and realize that they don't, they don't have what it takes, and they're looking forward to a better day. They're looking forward to a better kingdom. And Jesus says, don't worry, one day that will be yours.
Exactly. And dude, that's out of time. He is going to pronounce some woes next week. So he's going to contrast these exact words. So we'll do a little recap next week so you don't forget. But mm-hmm. we are out of time for this week. Eric, I will see you then.
All right, sounds good.